hamster with a blunt penknife would do it quicker.
Welcome back to Hamster with a Blunt Penknife, the Doctor Who commentary podcast. Jason, how was that mouthful of crisps that you just had? It's like, don't press play yet, I've got a mouthful of Pringles.
Very nice, thank you, Joe.
Yeah, good.
Thank you for lowering the tone in the opening 20 seconds of the recording.
You're so, so welcome, and you'll never be disappointed in that respect.
No, I know. I knew what I was getting into when I came over here, so...
I'm going to ask you a question about the length of Doctor Who stories. It's a question I've thrown out to quite a few people, but
okay.
Well, you and I have done the longest Doctor Who story. Yeah. I don't think it was relevant there because that story had to mutate in various ways to sustain that length. Is there an ideal length of a classic Doctor Who story?
Well, that's a difficult question because, I mean, give or take a few exceptions, they're generally four or six parts.
Yeah. I'm basically asking which is your preference.
The thing is, when... I think I've said this when we were doing Master Plan and possibly when we were doing Power as well. When they're done well, I can really enjoy a six-episode story. And there are some four-episode stories that I think, God, you're making this drag out a lot. You put the plot on pause for episode three or whatever, so...
Underworld, you mean?
Actually, I was thinking Deadly Assassin.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, we'll talk.
Episode three. Nothing happens in episode three.
Oh, I know, it's fabulous.
It's brilliant. It's doing nothing with style, but nothing happens.
That's true.
the plot does not advance one bit.
You may have mentioned that in your cliffhanger thread as well, you know.
I think I did. Robert Holmes, well, I know I mentioned in Cliffhanger 3, Robert Holmes writes fantastic stories, but I think he hates cliffhangers, so he doesn't do a very good job with them.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of his cliffhangers are absolutely terrible. They're just kind of there because the narrative structure requires them because you have to make it four parts or six parts.
I think a lot of writers are a bit irritated by cliffhangers, you know, disrupting the flow of the story, having to build up to it and then come away from it.
Well, I think there's a couple of ways you can approach a cliffhanger. One is to view it as the story has to stop at 25 minutes. Every 25 minutes, the story has to stop. What about if the plot advances every 25 minutes and your cliffhanger is a plot advancement? There are a lot of those. There are more of those than I expected, actually, when I was doing my cliffhanger thread. There's a lot more of those than I expected where the plot takes a turn at this point rather than just being a moment of jeopardy.
Yeah. Actually, I just thought of a story. Is there a story where every single cliffhanger does that? I did think of one, you know, that sort of veers in another direction at the cliffhanger. And that is, you're going to think I'm crazy, Terror of the Vervoids. The first episode, the hydroponic centre goes up and the Vervoids are released. The second episode, the woman's unveiled that's been pricked with the thing. The third episode, we're heading into the eye of the black hole of Tartarus.
Yeah, and that's kind of... fine. The only problem I've got with those is that the Ruth Baxter thing didn't go anywhere.
No, it's a good cliffhanger, though.
It's a good cliffhanger, but she had no further part in the plot. And the cliffhanger with the black hole suffered from JNT's insistence that the Doctor has to be the focus. The cliffhanger should have been the Hyperion 3 heading into the black hole, not the Doctor telling us that the Hyperion 3 was heading into the black hole.
For the third time. it's repeated several times.
We know what he's doing. Just make that the final shot of the ship going into the black hole instead of the Doctor's close-up on the face. But yeah, so...
But we've already said, haven't we, that this sustains six episodes... So it can be done.
Yeah, it can be
done. I think more often than not, you have padding in a six-parter.
Yeah, there are. But, you know, sometimes you have padding in a four-parter. Like I said, Deadly Assassin Part 3 is padding. There's a whole sequence in The Three Doctors where they stand around chatting. Dr. Tyler runs around in a circle and even says, that was a bit of a waste of time, wasn't it? Like, yes, it was. You had to stand there because other things in the plot had to move. Almost like in Silver Nemesis.
Oh, my God. I was just about to say Silver Nemesis to you. There's three comedy subplots in that. One per episode of about 5 minutes long.
And at one point, the Doctor and Ace literally have to sit on their ass doing nothing.
Yeah.
So that everyone else can get where they need to be for the plot to actually carry
some
on.
Strange pacing going on there.
There is some strange pacing going on, but... This story, I think, sustains six episodes quite nicely. I know, I didn't feel fatigued by it when I watched it at the BFI.
No,
I'm glad they split it up, because sitting in those seats for 2.5-3 hours would have been a bit of a challenge.
I think the only circumstance this would be a chore is if just this era wasn't for you. like we said, you know, it's got the action, it's got the military, the Navy, the Master, John Pertwee being a bit of a twat. Yeah, like, it's got all of those sort of tempos. If you don't like any of that, then yeah, of course this is going to be a bit... I talked to Matt Michael afterwards, and he was like, oh, God, I sit through six episodes of the bloody Sea Devils to get to the bar. I think he was there for the social part of it, because this just isn't his era. So fair enough.
Which is fair enough, but then if you're going to the BFI for the social part, just go for the social part. You don't actually have to buy the ticket to get into the
theatre.
You listen,
Matt, all right?
Just turn up to the bar. That's loads of people turned up at the bar afterwards. I went out of the door at the Sea Devils, and there's four people waiting outside who were not in there. And so I didn't know you were coming. And they'd come from Comic Con just up the road, and they'd come running down because they knew...
In fact, given how these seats are coveted, ungrateful people that aren't enjoying watching it should give up their seats for those that would.
Absolutely. If you're not going to enjoy the actual show, just come to the bar and have a drink afterwards. Because let's face it, but even with the Sea Devils, you know, that was finished by, what, 4 o'clock?
Yeah.
That's the rest of the evening in the bar.
Yeah.
They're great events. They really are worth coming. If you can't get a ticket to the actual showing, just turn up to the BFI at the end and enjoy the bar with everyone, because it's great fun.
Enjoy the quiz and get lash with everybody.
The Quiz of Rassilon, yes. Bit of a plug there for the Quiz of Rassilon, which I didn't participate in this time. But
And don't even bother taking part, because Cy Hart's always going to win. Whatever team he's on.
Get on his team. Get on Cy Hart's team. Well, that's why he does the Zoom quizzes with me.
Because
I did three of them, and he won them all. So
yeah,
like,
I did come to one of yours, and he won that, and I was like, oh.
So it's like, right, if you're going to win it all, you're going to have to do it instead.
I think I came second, though, you know. I was quite close.
I think you may well have been. We are looking at putting together another one. I will plug it now. It may take a while, because I remember we did the 90s quiz, and that took about a year to get set up for various reasons, because life got in the way. But we are looking at doing the 70s next.
Oh, marvellous.
So, at some point...
I said that about the 90s one and didn't show up, so...
Well, yes, there is that, yeah.
You take me to task now.
I sent you a message going, you're joining us, and 2 hours later I got a message going, I'm sorry,
I've not. I've been recording, I'm so sorry. I've got four bloody podcasts coming out of this house now, you know. my scheduling is not the best,
mad fool.
That's why it's best to just come round here and do these things, you know. Right, I know I'm definitely going to do this if I come to your house. Well, look, should we go and watch episode two?
Let's watch episode
two. We started with a question there. We sort of went...
I don't think we ever got to an answer. Four or six, depending on the writing. That's the optimum length for a classic Doctor Who story.
I think we provided some entertainment, though, which is what this is all about.
Well, so, yes.
Well, who started this one? Me. You got to count us in then. Go on. There you go.
Okay. Here we go. In 3, 2, 1.
Off we go. Did I press play? Yes.
You did, yes.
Horatio Nelson, Jason, is a close personal friend of mine.
Yes.
Is this the one where he says about, oh no, it's Ambassador to Death. My dear fellow, I simply don't happen to have a pass.
Yes.
Because I don't believe in him. That's why not.
Yeah. Well, you know, you could believe that John Pertwee might have been friends with Horatio Nelson. I know he knew various famous historical people during his time in the Navy. So.
Where does Pertwee fall for you, like the Third Doctor? Like, is he one of your favourites?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's going to sound such a cliche. I find it very difficult to decide who's my favourite, because I love them all. Because they're different. They've all got something good about them, and I really like Pertwee. I like the Third Doctor.
I talk with Cy Hart quite a lot, and I know he really has difficulty with early Pertwee, the sort of the arrogant, condescending, you know, in the mind of evil, the test of the Keller machine, that sort of people that talk about infallibility stuff. I am completely the other direction. I find that sort of rudeness where you're completely unaware of how rude you're being hilarious.
Well, I quite like the observation that was made in, I think it was one of these, was it Pete Lambert who did the demons?
Yeah. Oh, about the Doctor and the Master.
And he pointed out that the Doctor's the good guy, but he's a git.
Yeah.
And the Master's the bad guy, but he's charming and nice.
Yeah.
And that kind of good doesn't have to be nice.
Into a position where, not where we empathise with the Master, because he wants to do terrible things, but we like him more sometimes.
Yes. Yeah.
In fact, I think this story is a good example of that. I want to hang out with the Master quite a bit.
Yeah.
I think John Pertwee might have known that as well, you know.
Quite possibly. I do like this scene where it's John Pertwee's very good, but he notoriously hated the techno babble, and it is pretty obvious that he is reading his line. He's got his lines hidden behind his hand there about oscillators and outputs and things like that, and low frequency amplifiers. I think he's got his techno babble.
But he's looking at the syringe as if he's really concentrating on that. You know? Yeah,
absolutely.
Oh, wait a minute, he does a bit of business at the end there.
Bit of business with the syringe. Yeah.
Oh, I love the bit in the minute where he rewires the radio and it blows up in his face. That got a great laugh at the BFI.
It did. It did indeed. Yeah.
Joe is remarkably competent in this story.
She is.
Hulk, I think, writes her really, really well. He does the same thing again in Frontier in Space, or maybe less so in Colony in Space. Oh, wait, hang on a second. What's going on the wall there? Look.
Splashes of paint.
It looks like handprints.
Yeah.
Oh, don't you love the handgun for the Sea Devils?
This is one of the rare occasions in Doctor Who where they made a gun that didn't look like a gun.
Yeah.
And I really like it. And I wish they'd done it more, because sometimes the design of guns and weapons in this series is...
Yes.
A bit off.
Do you remember Hugo Lang's pistol in Twin Dilemma? Looks like it had come out of a cracker.
Yeah, I think one of the worst offenders, though, has got to be those bloody awful box things in Kinder.
Oh.
Those guns
are the power of life and death over all of you.
Yeah, which would count for a lot more if you weren't holding a ridiculous plastic...
Cardboard, I think.
...crappy gun thing.
Look at these... did you see those sort of Batman tilted angles that he was doing there in the set? He's just constantly trying to make this visually interesting. Oh, I love all of this. We do this twice in the same story of the monster trying to get in the door. So in this bit, he electrifies the door, and later on they melt down the door. And I love those sequences.
This I like the little things like the set dressing here, where they've got the sign about the electric shock. It just kind of adds the verisimilitude to it, rather than just being a box on the wall with danger or something. That's the kind of safety notice that you'd actually generally get in a place like that. So.
He explains in the commentary how they do this with the melting door.
Polystyrene and acetone.
But it looks so effective. And because he's backlit it red, it looks like it's sort of glowing.
Yeah, it does. It looks really good.
And I think that's perfect fuel for the kids as well. Melting down the door, the hand coming in.
Yeah.
Yeah, look at these angles. And again, the lighting. Oh, I love the Sea Devil screams as well.
And the smashed glass offset. We're not going to actually smash a window, but...
No, well, just like Spearhead from Space. Oh, Jane Blythe. Another competent... Two competent women.
Yay!
Well, it's... excuse me, I can point out one or two Hinchcliffe stories, you know, where a woman doesn't feature.
Yeah.
I believe she makes a fine cheese sandwich as well.
She does make
just,
a fine
just
cheese
to remind
sandwich.
Us it the sexism in Doctor Who.
What I particularly like about the way it's done in this story is that you have episodes of her being competent and respected by her peers and everything else, and then you get that prick Walker turning up going, "Bring me some toast and a newspaper," and it kind of adds more to the way that you feel about that idiot. I mean, we'll talk more about him when he actually appears, but I remember Katie Manning at the BFI saying she was getting really annoyed with him watching him on the screen.
I know he is, you know, that sort of character that's there to complicate the plot, and that he is, but you know, when I think of the Sea Devils, I do think of Walker. He's a very vivid character, always stuffing his face. Look at their chemistry. Look at how she smiles. She smiles at him like he is the most incredible man in the whole world.
They really do have a good chemistry going on, those two.
I mean, it's good here. I think it's out of this world in Curse of Peladon, the story before this. Princess Josephine of TARDIS.
Yeah. Oh, the Silurians, a bit of a name check for the Silurians. Go, oh, no, we weren't Silurians, they were Eocenes.
Yeah, that's why I learned the word misnomer as well.
Yeah.
Doctor Who is responsible for teaching me a lot of words, you know.
Yes.
Hydroponics.
Hydroponics. Antediluvian. Crops up a lot. Yeah. But yeah. And here we are explaining that, yes, this is basically the same story that we had in season 7. So it's the reptiles have come out of hibernation, but these ones live in the sea.
Which, you know, a lot of people say the Pertwee era is the first era to sort of bring in this continuity between stories, because it is in sort of one fixed time period. But actually, we did that with the Daleks and the Dalek invasion of Earth. We did that with the Cybermen in the moon base.
Yeah. Yeah.
What does it take for a Doctor Who monster to stick like this, then? Are we effectively saying this is the Sea Silurians?
This is basically the Sea Silurians. I think what it takes is not only a good design, but I think a good story to start with. Like, the Daleks have an excellent opening story. They not only are they visually superb, but if they'd been in a really crappy story, I don't think they'd have stuck. The Cybermen captured the imagination. The Tenth Planet is not maybe the best story.
They are chilling in the Tenth Planet. But they are
brilliant in it, the way they're written.
The eyes coming through that mask.
Yeah, now that it's all been remastered, we can see that.
Terrifying. I don't even know.
I don't think we were supposed to see that, but
more great stock footage. It just makes it feel real.
It does, even though it's a different helicopter from the one we saw taking off earlier. Oh, here he goes. He's going to zap his little radio.
I say so myself. That's a remarkably efficient piece of work.
And he does the comic business so well, John Pertwee, because he doesn't mug for it.
No, he shies away from comedy more often than not in Doctor Who, doesn't he?
He does. Well, when they first got him on, they said he wanted to play it straight down the middle as a dramatic role. But when he does have a little bit of comedy, it's always quite subtle and nicely done.
Oh, the Roger Delgado in the Navy uniform as an admiral, that is gold. Oh, and this is great, because Joe's like the voice of reason here, is he? Joe's the diplomat.
Yeah.
Pertwee just sort of boulders in, going, oh, I might, you know.
But this is what we were saying earlier on about this not being a unit story. If this was a unit story, the Doctor would walk in with his story. Yeah. The Brigadier would go, right, let's go and investigate. Whereas with Captain Hart, he's got to say, right, okay, first of all, got to convince him what the story is. Okay, fine, okay, but what do you expect me to do about it? If this was a unit story, there wouldn't be any of that. So I think moving it to this setting actually works very much in this story's favour. And especially as UNIT encountered the Silurians in the first place, if the Doctor went, oh, there's some more, the Brigadier would go, ah, right, okay, well, we know what to do with them.
Yeah.
Also,
you know, the repeated scene of the Doctor saying, you know, come on, man, use your intelligence and all this, it does add another 10 minutes to the running time.
it
pads it out a bit. This is an incredibly long-winded way of, because I don't think we really need the Master getting the spares. We could have just said, oh, well, I've got the spares, you know. But we need to show that he can get in and out of the prison, don't we?
We do, yes. Because, I mean, there's no reason why Trenchard couldn't have just ordered the spares.
Yeah.
And had them sent over. And of course, what it does do is not only does it give us the Master getting in and out of the prison, unfortunately. I just dropped my phone. That's what that bang was for anyone who's listening. Unfortunately, of course, to do that, we have to play into the security are fucking useless.
Yeah. Because he's basically just under a blanket in the back of the car. He's
driven up in the back, under a blanket in the car. And even when they decide to seal the thing, they've just driven out before the gates go down. It's just like, security around here is rubbish.
I do like this, though, that we're immediately, like, with the Silurians, it took about 4 episodes to get into the, this is our planet, we were here before man, let's share it. So he's saying here in episode 2, there's a peaceful way we can deal with this, I've been here before.
Yeah.
You know, it's got some shorthand to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So by referencing back to that story, it's like, okay, we know what the situation is. Now we know that what we're going to have to deal with is the different, and with the Masters in the mix, that's going to be the confounding factor. Unfortunately, I think one thing that does do is it takes away some of the variety among the Sea Devils themselves. Definitely, yeah. Because in the Silurians, we had the old Silurian, the young Silurian, the scientist who wasn't sure and all that. In the Sea Devils here, they're all kind of... There's a bit where one of them is almost won over until the attack happens, but that's kind of the only variation on them we get, and only one of them actually speaks.
The Master in this is both a curse and a blessing. I think he's a curse because, as you say, the Silurians are way more interesting than the Sea Devils and are better characters because they have more screen time. But this is far more entertaining for having Roger Delgado in it. Like, I would rather watch the Sea Devils, personally.
Yeah.
And I love the Silurians. But yeah. it takes itself incredibly seriously. Whereas this is having fun. The Master's in there. Saki quips. A sword fight with a sandwich halfway through. You know, action set pieces.
Yes.
Doctor Who has changed from Series 7 to Series 9.
It has, very much so.
Maybe this is sort of the biggest contrast.
Yeah, I think this works as... it does illustrate the contrast because it is essentially trying to tell the same story that we told 2 years ago. But just the different ways it does it.
Even like the ending, and we'll get there later on, I feel like sort of the consequence of... blowing, you know, the Doctor's just complicit now. Oh, well, yeah. We tried. Whereas at the end of the Silurians, it's absolute condemnation.
Yeah. Another thing I like about this one is that we've had the Master in every story in Series 8, hypnotising people left, right and centre. He fails to hypnotise anybody in this story, except possibly the guy right at the very end.
Yeah,
But his attempts don't go anywhere.
He uses his psychology, though. He manipulates people in this.
Or he beats the crap out of them like he just did with that poor unfortunate naval chap.
I like that, though, you know, when he's a bit more physical. Yeah. Oh, here's Trenchard. Look, Trenchard's trying very hard to distract them all whilst the Master gets his bits and bobs.
I really like that as a distraction, actually. That Trenchard he's playing up to his persona as a bluff old idiot, really.
Maybe there is more going on there than we thought then.
So to actually have him creating the distraction just by chatting about golf...
It's so awkward. Have you ever been in this situation where someone's going on and on and you're just like,
You just want them to go.
Like, and Joe, bless her, is sort of smiling sweetly. The Doctor's just like, well, if I'm ever able to conclude my business.
Yeah.
What's he asking them to do? Why is there going to be protests?
Because he was talking about stopping ships from going through that stretch of the water where the ships are sinking. But they said they're shipping lanes, so you can't just shut them down.
Do you know what? We just saw a reaction shot from Katie Manning when she saw the Master and her eyes were like bloody saucers. Do you remember that story about her and Jane Howe in Planet of the Daleks? Did you ever hear that? Where Jane Howe came in and she's playing everything really subtly and naturalistically. And she's like, okay. And then she saw Katie Manning go, oh, That's how we're playing. And that was a great example of that from Katie Manning there. Like, it was a very... I mean, you wouldn't get away with a reaction shot like that now, would you?
No. And again, here we are with the benefit of this being not a unit story. If someone said, I've just seen the Master, they'd be on that.
Who's that?
Whereas here, it's like, what are you talking about? Who, why, what are you... Who's the Master? What are you talking about? What do you want me to do? Etc. And it's like, he's just driven off and now we'll shut the gate.
Although, do you remember those lines in, I think it's the Time Monster, about, I think one of our agents has caught up with the Master. No, it turned out to be the Spanish ambassador.
I think that was in Colony in Space.
Oh, it's a funny line.
Well, it's a bit of an in-joke because Roger Delgado played the Spanish ambassador in another series.
Ah, okay. The Master.
Yeah.
Who is the Master? There you go, you just said it.
Nobody else would have a short beard and a naval uniform.
And you've got to remember, this is Pertwee right in the middle of his era here. It's halfway through his third season. So he's technically at his height at this point. Established, popular.
Yeah, very much so.
And they're throwing a bit of money at him as well. I mean, he must have been on cloud nine making this.
Yeah. Must have been.
Like you say, he gets to be on the water, all those modes of transport he gets to play about in.
Yeah.
Action. Oh, we're going to get that sword fight in a minute. Was that the end of three?
That's the end of this episode.
Oh, it's so great. You're a good doctor, but you're not that good.
You haven't seen the quality of my footwork yet. Oh, there's Trenchard in conference playing golf. Practicing his putting technique on the carpet.
So the inference seems to be, I think they talk about it, don't they, that he was the leader of a colony or something that went under.
He was the governor of a colony that declared independence shortly after he arrived. Yeah.
That's a very Malcolm Holt joke. But the idea is basically they shuffled Trenchard off to this castle prison just to get him out of their way.
Yeah, you can imagine. I think in the novelisation, Hulk bulks it up. Because, I mean, as we said on the book club with the Doomsday Machine, Malcolm Hulk's novelisations tend to beef out the characters a bit. And I think I think he goes on a bit about Trenchard's resentment that he should have been somewhere else. He should have been governing a colony. He should have been somewhere. And now he's stuck on this prison, on this island, guarding one prisoner.
I've got to say, without naming any names, in various workplaces that I've worked, I have seen people in positions of authority like this that are completely unsuited for the role.
Oh, I think we've all...
So I think we can all see like somebody that. In Trenchard.
Yeah.
I keep saying Trenchard. Is it Trenchard?
Trenchard.
Trenchard.
Trenchard or Trenchard. But it's pronounced... Yeah, it's spelt Trenchard.
No buts, Jason. Just do as I ask. Sorry.
Not a chance, you know, the sort of thing you ask.
Oh, you can only guess. I'll tell you. Look at what he's wearing now, the master, that cloak.
Yeah.
He looks like the epitome of evil. That's slightly glam as well.
It is a little bit, yeah.
I can see somebody on Drag Race, you know, doing Roger Delgado. There is something a little dangerous about him in this story. Like you said there, about him sort of suddenly jumping to attack people and things like that. I feel like sometimes he can be written a little sitcom. Like that's where we end up in the Time Monster.
Yeah.
You know, when he's pleading at the end. So...
That was remarkably easy for him to pull that thing off the wall and just shove something over the security camera, wasn't it? That's just...
He is planning on killing the Doctor now, though, isn't he?
Oh, yeah.
We're just going to watch it now.
Yeah, why not? This is a bit odd because he goes, oh, that grill seems to be blocked. That's the one that's got the CCTV camera in it, so it's not actually an air conditioning thing at all. So what?
I think they may have shunted off all the guards to this prison as well because they were a bit inept.
A bit inept.
Although then putting in, you know, the world-class super villains might have been a silly idea. Oh man, Pertwee must have got this script and just been delighted. Blindfold golf. Sword fights. Like, I know I do this a lot, but I'm not being ridiculous. Like, he has got something, Pertwee. Mm. And I don't mean sex appeal, but he's just got some sort of magnetism that I really, really love about him.
He's very much got leading man energy.
For somebody who we know is incredibly nervous as an actor... he seems so assured, like on screen.
Yeah,
and he's just got so much presence.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm a massive Pertwee stan. Can you tell?
No, you hide it well, Joe. Hide it well. No, I think he's excellent. It's never boring watching him on screen.
Those Venetian blinds were not a good idea, were they?
No, there they are waving in the breeze.
Oh dear. Almost advertising the fact that it's CSO.
Mm.
Oh, look, he's still going to play it on for a little bit, the master.
Oh, dear.
It does feel like at this point, and in the Time Monster as well, it's just a big game now.
Yeah.
Mind you, it kind of started that way, didn't it, in Terror of the Autons?
It did, yeah.
until you whip out the pistol, if you'll pardon the expression.
Yes. Here we get John Pertwee. Hi!
Akirai!
Why are there swords on the wall? Oh, fuck no, outside?
Because we want to do a sword fight, that's why. Well, what do you think then about... Because John Pertwee talks about this in interviews, quite eloquently, actually, about how absurd it is that they don't best each other, because they're both supposed to be, you know, the biggest super brains in the universe, the Doctor and the Master. And he says, it's because they're friends, because they're brothers, because they're, etc., because they love each other, really.
Yeah.
What, do you buy into that?
There's definitely a connection between them. and you do get the impression, partly through Roger Delgado's performance here, which I think informed, well, pretty sure informed every subsequent iteration of the Master. And they left the blind open or closed there, so you could see the bright yellow CSO screen behind him.
These lines, violent exercise, makes me hungry.
But you do get the impression that if the Master ever did actually kill the Doctor, he'd be genuinely upset about it.
Yeah.
But then the Doctor gives back the sword, so it's kind of... kind of lose the kind of idea that this is supposed to be properly dangerous combat, because the Doctor's just like, I'll give him back his sword, why not?
But it is... Oh, I could really see the stuntman's face there.
I don't know what you're talking about. You definitely do. Not.
And, you know, I also... I've been talking wonderful things about the production, but that sped-up footage... Why? That's not a trick that's used often in Doctor Who, and I can see why. This whip pan. That's really dramatic, him throwing that knife, I think.
It is, but again...
Oh, you're not impressed.
Not a great cliffhanger, because we know damn well that knife is not going to end up between the Doctor's shoulder blades. So
because it's a foregone conclusion, there's no suspense there.
It's nicely done, but no, there is no... You know, it's a cheat. I mean, it's kind of... I don't know. Some of them can be done really well. I really like the crossbow firing at the end of part 3 of Mysterious Planet.
Oh,
and
Merlin
says, who are you hunting? You. And he fires the thing. Now, you know he hasn't shot the Doctor, but it's so nicely done.
Well, but plus, someone is shot as well, though.
Yeah, and someone does get shot.
So it's not technically a cheat.
Plus, of course, it's one of only two of the cliffhangers in that whole story. It isn't a close-up of Colin Baker. Although they do put one in just before he fires the crossbow.
But, I mean, in terms of class, yeah... That sword fight, I mean, I've just whinged about the spell up footage and all of that. The witty lines, it's Delgado and Pertwee having a sword fight. I mean, it is fucking classy.
It is, but it doesn't quite fit the whole, the Master is the mortal enemy and they're doing something that's going to involve lots of death and destruction. It's like, now they're just having fun.
It's essentially another sort of distraction away from the plot. We've got another episode out of this now.
Yeah, we're into two episodes. We should have to see where episode 3 takes us.
Let's go, shall we?